way. We'll get our money some other way. I mean, to separate fundraising from book, we'll raise funds one way. And then when we go out and distribute books, we won't be trying to get money from people, and therefore they'll look upon our book distribution more kindly. But this decision only made things worse. This began the era of what one devotee called pickonomics, the pick. Because this devotee slang in North America was going out on the pick, picking money from people. And it said pickonomics. And I guess the first thing that happened in this effort to separate book distribution from fundraising was, at least in my area, was carved candles, door-to-door with carved candles, this method of where devotees could, some paraphernalia that wasn't related to Krishna consciousness, was these candles in a mold that would be dipped in different colored wax, and then you carved them, and they would have curlicues and look all fancy, and it was easy to do, and then you could sell them, you know, using cheap, free devotee labor and cheap material, and you could do it in any basement. You could make money. So that's what started, was the carved candles. See, now different things happened in different places. Then in Canada, they discovered cheap carmi paintings, Korean schlock art. The bad art. And this was, the painting became a thing. And other places they discovered stickers with sports teams and hats with sports insignia and logos and various other things.
Records,
yeah.
Perfume,
that was in Australia, yeah. Perfume. Paraphernalia became the thing. Well, whatever, yeah. And the Christmas marathon became the best. So those would be around. So that became. And you know what happened? The money increased.
What about the books? Were still debating?
Yeah, but now it became a problem because now you had more books than you could deal with, at least in North America. Suddenly the money increased. It was a whole lot easier to sell these Korean paintings. Now, they were done in different ways and with different degree of truthfulness in different places. In the zone I was in, it was pretty good because in one way they just organized a legal business that had stores and malls. Eventually it came to this. And it was a legitimate, non-related business. In other places, people are going door to door with the paintings saying, I'm an art student and I'm working my way through college selling these paintings and this is what I did, you know, and various things like that. Where with the records, it became absolutely, and the stickers, it became literally criminal. And there's some places they had something called Midnight Sankirtan, which was literally stealing. And I won't even mention Japan, but I'll mention it by saying I'm not going to mention it. That's a rhetorical device. But anyway, so there was a range. And this wasn't happening all over the world either, I'm sure. I'm talking about North America. And in North America, it was different in different places. And even in the places where things were pretty bad, there were very pure devotees, and there were devotees who were, you know, once you got into paraphernalia, you know, I mean, you could put anybody out on the streets if they were a hustler. And in fact, the more cunning and kind of conniving and even criminal their mentality, the more successful they could be, right?
What boost?
Books were going out, but the trouble is how to get the books out. And there were too many books. Suddenly, you could send all this money to the BBT, and success in Sankirtan was now measured by how much money was coming into the BBT. That became the measure. The BBT would send you books, and the books, while people were going out and they were selling books, and yeah, they didn't have to do anything, because the books now practically are giving them away, 50 cents, a dollar, give anything. In some places, they would take the books and put them in shopping bags, go into apartment buildings and hang them on all the door knobs. The question became how to get rid of the books, what to do with them. And in North America, at any rate, there was an underground trade in discounted BBT book points. Book credits, you know? Like, for example, I may have sent the BBT, you know, $100,000. Don't send me any more books. Probably because my basement is full. But now I got $100,000 credit. So I go to another temple and I say, if you give me $25,000, I'll transfer to you $100,000 worth of BBT book credits. And so there was this whole trade going back and forth. What to do? Up until very recently in the Detroit temple, we were still distributing books that were actually got from the BBT 20 years ago. They're in the basements. And they're just piling up in different basements of the houses, you know? People just couldn't get rid of them. Meanwhile, like in Detroit, it was very big with the sports things, and the street pick was their thing. I remember when I first became GBC of Detroit, in fact, it was Brudger Bihari there. He was going out with devotees doing book distribution in the airport. And I remember standing there just to the new GBC coming, and this is 87, just when the whole thing is beginning to collapse. But it was still going on at that time. And Brudger Bihari says to the temple president, I need a van to go out for book distribution. And he said, no, we need the van for Sankirtan. Collecting money. So the meaning of Sankirtan had actually changed. Subtly, slowly, without anybody's knowing or being fully conscious of it. From book distribution to money collecting. That was Sankirtan. So this is what was going on. So, and I said this kept up, and then, of course, eventually we ended up in even worse legal trouble. Because finally focusing down, first was Berkeley and Hamsaduta, but finally focusing in North America on New Vrindavan, where they had perfected their techniques beyond anyone's wildest dreams of money collecting. And it finally attracted the attention of the civil authorities. Of course, there was some other things going on too there. So I'm telling you this history. I mean, on the one hand, I have to say, you know, books were going out, people were reading them, people became devotees, and things like that. On the other side, there was definitely, shall we call it a streak or an element or an aspect of Dumbha Yajna in this kind of thing, because people found out the way to get the effect of piety without the actual piety. Because what happened is actually the vast amounts of money that were coming in from what was now being called Sankirtan really became the economic basis of the zonal acharya system, at least in many parts of the world, certainly in North America. See, what gradually began to happen is first everybody was enthusiastic to do this fundraising, let's call it. But as time went by, people did not get from it. Most people, most devotees did not get from it the same thing they used to get from distributing books and preaching Krishna consciousness and doing Harinam, which used to be called Sankirtan. They didn't get the same spiritual advancement. One aspect that used to be preached was that actually when somebody bought your paraphernalia, they were making spiritual advancement. They didn't know you were a devotee because you had a wig on and were in disguise. Or maybe you had hair in the later stages. You dispensed with the wig and just went for the hair. You had a wig on. You were dressed in karmic clothes. You were representing yourself as, you know, Appalachian charities or whatever, this, that, the other thing. Or a legitimate business, but not connected with ISKCON. People had no idea. But it was still thought that if you bought this perfume or this painting or this, you made spiritual advancement. Now, I had remembered years before where a letter had sent out with Prabhupada's approval saying that people who bought spiritual sky incense didn't make spiritual advancement the same way that somebody that bought a book that it was a transaction. They paid money and got something for it. It wasn't a charitable donation. And so they didn't make the same spiritual advancement. The devotee who was earning money by this way and giving all the fruits, certainly that devotee made some spiritual advancement. He was working for Krishna and collecting funds and then giving it to Krishna. So the devotee was making spiritual advancement. I don't think you could say the same thing about the person who was... But it was told that now everybody who buys a painting and everyone who buys this perfume, you know, they're making some subtle spiritual advancement. New Vrindavan actually had the doctrine of Ajanta Sukriti. If you cheated them, they made spiritual advancement. They didn't know to whom they were... you were taking their money and they were... But anyway, gradually over the course of time, fewer and fewer devotees every year were able to do this. The ones that were able to do this were the ones usually that were particularly talented at it and good at it. The many would drop out. But the money was coming in at a fairly regular basis, and the devotees were living pretty good. There was a lot of money coming in. And meanwhile, of course, as the movement was getting older, there were many householders in the temple communities. They were all living off of this money. In those days in North America, people still had the sort of, you know, do sankirtan. So they were householders, and they had children, and they had automobiles. There may be, you know, a temple would have 15 registered, insured automobiles, which actually were for the exclusive use of one particular devotee or another, but were all in the temple's name. So this was extraordinarily expensive. But every year, during the Christmas marathon, it was the spiritual master's job to fire up all his disciples to go out and do this, you know, marathon fundraising for the BBT. And every year it seemed to get a whole lot harder for people. So people were becoming discouraged. In some places it was illegal. So one of the effects of the end of the Zonal Acharya system was also the end of this kind of economics. And the end of this economics, because it was also just dying a natural death. Fewer and fewer people were making the money, and many of those no longer felt like giving it up. They were making so much money, it was going back to supporting all these devotees who were sitting around the temple. Why should I give it to them? So they were keeping more and more. So what happened a lot of places is that these people who were very good at it, they just kept more and more and gave less and less and less. So it was dying a natural death anyway. I'm talking about what I know in North America and parts of it. So these two things kind of happened simultaneously. With the end of the Zonal Acharya thing, nobody really had the guts or the desire even to go and fire people up to do this kind of thing. Most devotees didn't want to do it anymore anyway. And so at least ISKCON in North America went into an economic collapse, which did as much to destroy people's faith as gurus falling down, believe me. Because they had surrendered to Krishna, and Krishna was providing, and all of a sudden, boom, it stopped, you know? And I had to go out of my own. That was such a shock to people. What else did I want to say about this? Something else. So this is the history of kind of what happened. Oh, I know. In a way, you see, the mechanism going on now in some places where this was going on, where it was really egregious, I mean conspicuously bad, you had spiritual leaders, acharyas, gurus, who were actually already compromised in their spiritual life. Not all of them were. But the places where it was really bad tend to be the places where people were the most compromised in their spiritual life. They were not chanting rounds, or they were already breaking regular principles. Nevertheless, they managed to keep that, even though this thing is going wrong with me, I'm not doing this, still, look, I'm a success. I must be doing something right. In spite of what this is going on, my bad conscience, see, we have money, temples are being opened, more and more this, more and more that, more and more books are being distributed. So this is how it happens. It's, in a way, you see, it snuck up on people. It wasn't that anyone consciously planned to be a hypocrite. But gradually, this is why it's, you know, Dharma Shaglani is not a dropping off, but a gradual decline. Now, of course, we have book distribution reviving in North America. We're trying to be really, really careful do it in a different way. It seems to be successful. We didn't need all this anyway, as it turns out, the change-up and all this other stuff. And in some ways, you see, we are just trying to act over our heads. We wanted to be, you know, too advanced, too fast for what we were, and so we cheated. There's a story that I once read in a Buddhist scripture. There was Zen in the Art of Archery, or a book about Buddhism, which I used many years ago. This tells the story of when apparently in Zen Buddhism, some teachers, you know, Zen has this idea of satori, or sudden illumination, where suddenly the veil of Maya lifts and you see things as they are. And I don't know the merits of this system, but I'm just telling the story. So this one Zen master taught Zen realization by archery. And he would shoot an arrow, and when he had the... when his mind was completely one-pointed, like one-pointedness of mind, his concentration was completely there, he was totally alert and yet completely relaxed, his mind, his eye, his arm, the arrow, the bow, the target were as one, and he let go of the bow, the arrow would just go right into the center of almost like its own will, and the string would give this particularly distinctive twang, this sound. So he would say to his student, an American naturally, "Now you do it." Well, he couldn't get this twang. He couldn't get it. That's because he's all messed up. His mind is distracted. He has so many thoughts. He's conflicted. He's out of harmony, you know. He couldn't get this twang. So the story is told. So this American student is trying and trying and trying to get this twang. And one day he discovers that if he just holds his finger at a certain angle and pulls back on the string and lets the tension of the bow release it, he got the twang just by this little angle. So very proudly he marches into his teacher and says, "And twang, there it is," you know. And the teacher just looks at him in disgust and walks out of the room. So we were trying to preach Srila Prabhupada. We couldn't quite manage it to do it the real way, and so there was an element of twang, you know, this false twang in our efforts. So that's why this is part, in my mind, I always think of a certain era in ISKCON, which actually began quite while Prabhupada was with us, as the age of bluff, where people wanted to make a lot of advancement really fast, put themselves publicly on a much higher platform than they could sustain, and then started to make different adjustments to appease a guilty conscience. And this is one of the adjustments. If Krishna is pleased with somebody, he'll make sure that there's many books going out and you'll have money to build temples and so on. We have money to build temples and books are going out, therefore Krishna is pleased. You know the logic, huh?
It's false logic, huh? If you say A implies B, then you say B, therefore A. That's wrong, you know? If Krishna loved you, there will be money. There is money, therefore Krishna loves us. All horses have four legs. If it's a horse, it has four legs. Fido, who goes bark, bark, has four legs. Therefore, Fido is a horse. This is called affirming the antecedent, but affirming the consequence rather than logic. The correct form is A is B, A therefore B. That's his false logic. If Krishna is pleased, there'll be money. I have money, therefore Krishna is pleased. Look at all the people with money who are not pleasing Krishna, you know. But somehow or other it was taken like that, you see. The false logic was there to help people delude themselves like this and think somehow or other we had the mercy of Krishna. And so when we had a movement, when a movement started on the second level of leadership that something is wrong in ISKCON, and it was taken by the main leaders as a challenge, the first response was, what have you done to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world? What have you done? That was the line. What have you done to spread Krishna consciousness? This is from Bhagavan, actually. What have you done to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world? But when the smoke cleared, what had anyone done? When the tally was in, you take all the money that the BBT made in North America in this time, then subtract everything we spent on court cases, anti-cult cases that Kirtananda spent on his legal defense. Do all those subtractions and see what the sum total is, how much money actually came in. Now I want to say this, because people will hear this tape, I am not against book distribution, I am not against Sankirtan, and I want to recognize the genuine achievement and spiritual advancement of all those devotees who actually distributed Prabhupada's books. And I'm sure everyone made some spiritual advancement, even if we didn't always do it the best way. I mean, we had good intentions, but there's a saying in English, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Well, sometimes good intentions aren't enough. Any questions about this episode?
Things being rectified now.
I believe so. What do you think, John Mashmi? Yeah, I think things are being rectified. We're being very, very careful how we train our book distributors. And we find out that we send people out. And one thing we're trying to do all over is get people to read Prabhupada books and appreciate them more and more and distribute them on an authentic basis of devotional service. And we find it works.
South Africa, we do lots of ATG subscriptions, like 2,000.
Yeah, you're very successful there.
And we found, because people get it regularly every 2 months, not only that, the devotee who actually started out, they find out what the birthday is and they send them a birthday card with, Mother, it's Krishna's Abhishek. Is that on the front? Birthday greetings, and they say that,
Dear Jared,
they give them a box of sweets when they have a birthday. People get so touched.
Yeah.
Sometimes they, although they're BTG subscription distributors, subscribers, they'll get an extra book maybe once a year.
There are the ways and means that if we're honest, Krishna will honestly give us how to do it. There's no pretense, Yeah.
There must have been devotees who must have felt there's something wrong.
Yeah, there were.
There were this divine discontent or...
Well, the divine discontent was actually manifest. You see, the trouble with divine discontent is people couldn't be frank about it. For various reasons, the concealment.
So
it looked good. This was, if they had been frank about it, we could have solved the problem, but then nobody, apparently no one at least who is building up a reputation or their own self-respect in this book distribution had it in them to say, there's something wrong about this. And those people that said there was something wrong quickly got branded as being against Sankirtan or something else. I wish, if I had been more advanced, what I should have done has been able to go out and show them how to do it right, and I couldn't. I couldn't do any better than anybody else. I knew what was wrong, but I didn't have the potency to do it right, unfortunately.
But then you would have been lumped in with the others. Because it was a national thing, and if in other places...
But don't you think if I was more surrendered to Krishna and said, I'm going to go out and distribute books distribution the honest way and just do it until it works, and found something out, somehow Krishna would have empowered me to get other people, and, we could have done something. But in some ways, we were just serving on the platform of which we were capable. When I look at what Prabhupada, to me, just to get to some of the root questions that come up with this, Prabhupada was dealing with the raw materials he was handled. You know, the idea I think of is as a man being washed up on a desert island. He has to build shelter. All he's got is, you know, bent sticks and broken twigs and somehow or other, and he puts these together and makes a shelter. It looks awful, but at least it gets him out of the rain. You know, so similarly, Prabhupada did what he could with the material he had. And he accomplished something, and I think in Prabhupada's mind he understood that the good that's done will be eternal and the bad is temporary. That's my take on it, for what it's worth. Yeah.
I think
what do you want to do? Stop trying to preach Krishna consciousness because of the distributed book, because this is all we were capable of?
And Prabhupada would initiate people so easily because
there's... Yeah, sure, there's so many...
Who else was there to initiate?
Yeah.
Anyone to encourage everyone to get
everything? Well, let them get a word in edgewise.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The Dumba wasn't just... It seemed to me almost like across the board. I distributed books in the old way to change up and... And did paraphernalia. I went through the whole gamut.
Yeah, you're a veteran, huh?
And but we were actually trained in kind of in those early days when things started going off. And kind of an exploitive, prideful mentality.
An exploitive, prideful mentality.
It's part of the training rather than...
You're really right, actually. That's true.
Rather than that of a servant. And the bluffing that you described was across the board because the managers became proud with the big money.
Yeah.
But the Sankirtana was also very proud if they were able to do that.
Yeah. I noticed, by the way, when Boysen says, when he talks about these things, it was this attitude that went along with it. There was so much contempt for the karmis, the ones that you were cheating. They almost like looked down upon them.
Oh, yeah.
Contempt. And then the competition among devotees for being the biggest and everything, it became full of false ego. Well, Prabhupada said there could be competition without false ego. In this case, there was.
But there was a real absence of any kind of compassion.
Absence of compassion. No.
But of the two, it was much more spiritually beneficial, I felt, of distributing books even with a change-up than selling oil paintings.
Okay.
Stickers.
Well, you know from experience.
But every Christmas marathon, we'd lose like 5 or 10 devotees in a zone.
From the Christmas, from the painting,
paraphernalia.
Yeah, devotees would drop out. It was very hard on people's consciousness to do that. It just didn't have that same restorative purpose. He's saying even with the change-up. So you think my account's fairly straightforward, huh? So there's somebody who lived through it. He was actually a frontline man. I was a rear guy, rear echelon.
So there were regions at that time in the world, in ISKCON, where they were doing pure Sankirtan, like the zone of Hare Krishna and so on.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
So how come there was no interrelation between these?
I don't have the slightest idea.
Because there were places like Germany.
Yeah.
Even in the 70s, they were doing straight groups.
Yeah. What? You have an idea?
Here's one angle. I don't know if you ever saw that. This is really crazy. But... this astrological calculation that what's his name did of ISKCON. He said that the homeland, America, would be hit the hardest.
The homeland would be hit the hardest
during the Rahu period.
Yeah, ISKCON's Rahu period. Right.
When ISKCON went out of the Rahu period and entered Jupiter,
That
was the first month in 15 years the United States became the number one book distribution.
Is that right?
Who did it?
He was the one that was originally designated the ISKCON.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
Down in
Lachua, yeah, right. I can't remember his name either.
He's pretty fascinating. That's pretty fascinating.
Chan Sundar, yeah.
But you can also add in the factor that nowhere in the world is there more passion than America.
But in Australia it was pretty bad.
Oh, they burned that to the ground.
Yeah, Australia was pretty bad. England, I guess, to some degree, was pretty bad. I don't know for sure. Where paraphernalia was really big in the end. But one thing is why, you know, there was no sharing is the Zone Acharyas were very much like kings in competition with each other, you know. And so they didn't either confess their failures or share in their secrets of success with each other very much. Because it was a zero-sum game, and one person's gain was always another person's loss, as far as they were...
Win-lose.
Yeah. They call it a zero-sum game. Yes?
Could you tell a point of view on Sancho Leo, which comprises also a book distribution
Now, about 3 years, we have to intensely distribute books, because after that will come like a big war, and people must get this mercy from these books before this big war is all around the world.
Yeah.
I remember that Prabhupada told, you can read with Prabhupada, yeah, that it was in Amsterdam. He said that on the year 2000, people will live underground, so it's understood that it will be, over that time, a big war.
Well, I think we should always distribute books as if there's no tomorrow.
And what's about this war?
The war? I don't know. I never remember Prabhupada saying the year 2000. But,
he had a morning walk in Mayapur. He spoke about World War
II. He did speak about a war. And he predicted that it would start with India and Pakistan. And then it didn't. And he said very soon, and it didn't come. And then he said Krishna changed his mind.
So the book about the archives called
War. Huh? What?
There's a book by the archives called World War III.
Right, so you could. Anyway, World War III is a whole other topic. But in general, one should not think that we have so much. Just like thinking, well, I have so many years of my own life to become Krishna conscious, let me take it easy. We should also think that we should do things with a certain urgency, but not in a crazy, passionate way either. Yeah?
Not long ago, I don't remember for which reason, we were asking this question.
The war, the upcoming war,
and Mara was saying that in the past also the movie had been coming up to Papa and saying there's going to be a war, and so what should we do? Should we build houses
underground? Yeah.
Should we do this? Should we do that? And Papa at some point told them that you should make lifetime plans for spreading Krishna.
Yeah. Yeah, he said not to plan on everything coming to an end. He just said, go on with your service. And go on, you know, don't think at a certain point we're going to stop and we have to do this stuff. That's what he said. And that's true. That's still a good policy. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So our course of affairs is, I hope, today's Thursday and Friday. Maybe we'll get through this chart, or most of it. So the other two handouts I gave you, stuff written by me, you should have, make sure you have read by. Maybe we'll start on them tomorrow. But,
Did you pass out the letters to page 10?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, I missed it.
I don't know if I still have them floating around. I don't. And then I'm getting some more material from Boysen to photocopy, which I hope to have to you tomorrow, and where he talks about how he counsels people. And we want to get into a few little things that he has and how he deals with people, which I think are helpful suggestions and things like that. So we'll have those pages from Boysen too. Okay? We're coming pretty close to the end, right? And a little more week after this week, huh? See, the really bottom end of this chart is not so much of interest to us, the disintegration. You disintegrate, at least just usually out of his compound. Although not always. We get a little close now and then. But the things that we usually deal with are in this area of concealment. So we talked yesterday about these bluffing responses, and we analyzed, at least I analyzed, certain aspects of book distribution in terms of this, where we made mistakes, again as an attempt to kind of compensate for our internal sense of personal failure by proving by this other activity that we were actually great devotees. He mentions here now, you'll see on this chart, shifting responsibility, another self-protective and concealment device he has upon other persons or objects or upon an organic scapegoat. So organic scapegoat means hypochondria. I can't do this or that because I'm always problems with my body, Prabhu. I'm sick all the time, and so on. The most common one that we encounter is the shifting of responsibility upon other persons or objects. Here he lists bitterness, suspicion, and jealousy as the characteristic attitudes. And when that develops, escape into self-assertive ideation and delusional misinterpretation. And the end result is paranoid types. Now, we actually see this sometimes. So the idea is now, if I am feeling I'm a failure in my spiritual life, then another concealment device is to blame it on others. Instead of taking responsibility myself, it's somebody else's to blame. Now, and you see bitterness, suspicion, and jealousy. And ISKCON, for all its faults, is often the one that's the object of such blame and suspicion. Not to say that ISKCON doesn't have real faults, but the attitude, the productive attitude of a devotee is, of course, actually to always say, even when it's somebody else's fault, is not to take that into account. When there's some reversal of circumstances, the attitude of a devotee that's productive for spiritual advancement is we're supposed to say, this is my karma. I had it coming to me, and await the mercy of the Lord. Now, that may not be... Well, anyway, that's the attitude that's actually... But oftentimes, people, when they have problems or difficulties, they want to blame it on somebody else. So we find people who have been a long time in the movement and they aren't happy. Now, the reason anyone is not happy is because they're not Krishna conscious. You can say basically that if someone is Krishna conscious, they'll be happy. So there's a lot of people who have somehow or other become disappointed in their spiritual life. And they want to find out who's to blame. They'll say, I spent so many years in ISKCON doing so many things, I sacrificed so much, now what do I have to show for it? And a lot of times you'll see there's bitterness toward ISKCON itself. ISKCON is to blame. ISKCON sometimes, on its turn, or like ISKCON officials, also blames the other person. You see, the actual truth of the matter is, because Prabhupada said that when somebody leaves, it's 50% our fault. We're going to get settled with the fans here. It's 50% our fault. So really, it would normally happen, you see, like often it would happen, especially in the early days when somebody would leave the temple. It was a common ritual. I mentioned this, to have all the devotees kind of get together informally or even sometimes formally and discuss everything that was wrong with this devotee. And that way the community itself, even if they were unfriendly, hostile, unhelpful, the community itself kind of absolves itself of his blame. It says, you know, he should have been Krishna conscious. It was his fault. He was attached to sense gratification. So this happens on both sides, I mean to say. And the person who left, sometimes if they are still having ideals of Krishna conscious, then they become very bitter. The people that just leave and aren't bitter, you never see them again because they've given up on their ideals. The people who still have the ideals, somehow or other. They stay around and are very bitter. You know? And that bitterness is expressed in the fact that this is what I described as the donut model of ISKCON communities, which you see in many places. It's very funny. But that you know, let's say here, this is, you know, the inner core, right? The temple and temple devotees who are regularly serving and participating. And then you have the outer group. Now this outer group, this person will very infrequently come to the temple, once in a while, Janmas, ever so often. But these people in this outer group, they're always interacting with each other a whole lot more. They have in common, you know, they're having been in ISKCON, having been temple resident sometime, or having been at one time on a higher level of Krishna consciousness. So they have a whole lot of more interrelationships among themselves. Their discussion is about the temple. Their talk is about the temple. Then sometimes they even obsess with the temple. Although they rarely ever go. And usually there are many more people out here than there are in here. And both sides are blaming each other. The temple resident devotees are blaming them, and they're blaming the temple resident devotees. Because unfortunately, a lot of the times the people out here, they were first here, and maybe they took vows of sadhana. Now they've fallen away from their vows. And so the temple resident people, you know, they're looking down on them for this. These people are already feeling, you know, condemned by their own conscience. So why do they associate? Why do the people they have to associate with all with? A lot of times they don't have a lot of association with other people who were never involved with ISKCON. Maybe one or two. Maybe there's some overlapping with other social groups. But often, this is what you see. This is a very interesting formation. I don't know. But I noticed this in many ISKCON centers in America. And when I described it at Radhadesh at a seminar, everybody seemed to know what I was talking about. This kind of donut formation here. They're more on the outside. I mean, so you may see it. Now, other places where there's more maturity, this really shouldn't happen, this kind of formation. But the devotees are blaming the people on the outside, because the devotees in the temple, sometimes we devotees who are living in temples and we take responsibility, we have obligations toward the people that come to Krishna consciousness. You know the word obligations? We have things we ought to do for them.